Tell us about the film.
Well, it has been a journey. You know, we finally, it is a movie that was going to, it's been about 3.5-4 years in the making. It was going to have an initial theatrical release, and of course COVID put an end to that, and now it's going out exclusively online, at least until we can get back in the movie theaters. So here we go, and now we're dependent upon, of course, the ability of independent platforms to carry this film and avoid the censorship that is now so pervasive from all of the other major platforms. And so far, so good. So the great thing about the free market economy, Bobby, is that new people step into the breach. And when people censor themselves, like Zuckerberg and others, then that's what they're effectively doing, cutting themselves out of the market, and new people step in. So let's see how this one plays out. But so far, so good. It's playing in France, Germany, Italy, it's in Spanish, it's in Russian. So Vlad the Impaler may be watching it as we speak.
Andy, you really changed this debate on multiple occasions, but the last real extraordinary impact that you had was when you put out the movie Vaxxed, which I think was at 2016?
That's right, 2016, absolutely.
And Vaxxed encountered a lot of censorship, including most notably the censorship at the Tribeca Film Festival. Tell us what happened there.
That was an extraordinary moment. I remember we put it into Tribeca as an independent film festival. We went for one festival. That was it. And it was Tribeca. That was clearly a very, very important festival for independent filmmakers. It was accepted into Tribeca, and then a little later, they wouldn't be announced. They wouldn't announce it. And we thought, okay, so they're just a bit sensitive. And then finally, I got a call from Dell, the producer, one day saying, Andy, we got a problem. We've just been pulled from Tribeca. And that was one of the worst days. And then just a few days later, of course, Robert De Niro went on to national news and said, talking about Tribeca, the only thing he would talk about is the film that never played, and that is Vaxxed, and saying, we shouldn't have done that. In retrospect, that was not a good idea, and everybody should watch this film and make up their own mind. And that's what happened. And suddenly we had this De Niro effect where it exploded worldwide. You and I know, Bobby, if it had played at Tribeca, maybe 100 people would have seen it, and that would have been kind of it. But because of the censorship and because of De Niro coming out and supporting the film, God bless him, then it just went everywhere. And from that moment, it really changed the debate, because up to that point they had been able to close it down, but they had no way of dealing with the reaction to censorship. When they tried to tell people what they're going to watch and how they're going to watch it, and people weren't going to tolerate that, and suddenly it exploded worldwide. And of course, Vaxxed was a story unique in some respects. It was the first time we'd ever had an insider from the CDC in the vaccine safety office coming forward and saying, I was in charge of the study, I designed the study, I collected the data, I analyzed the data, and we committed fraud. We left children in harm's way. We deliberately put children in harm's way for 14 years, and I can no longer live with that. So it was an extremely powerful story, and they found it very difficult to deal with. This is a story in a similar vein, and it is about the fraud, the lies, the corruption, the deceit, the deliberate injury that has been caused to US children, and by extension, and a point you make very well in the film, children around the world, because of bad policies about unsafe vaccines hurting children worldwide.
I think one of the most impactful parts of this, the film, of course, called 1986, and it's kind of a play on the words of 1984 to invoke the kind of authoritarian, dystopian interventions that Orwell predicted in his novel. By 1986, there were 11 vaccines. So they were already adding them. And probably the most impactful one was the DTP, the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine. that was added, I think, around 1979 or 1980. And that vaccine, of course, today is effectively banned in all Western nations. Bill Gates is still giving it to 161 million African children every year, but mainly with white populations, we don't get them because it was either killing or badly injuring one in every 300 people. And you gave me the memo that I had never seen before that you alone obtained, which was a secret memo that was done by a, I think it was a UCLA scientist who NIH was paying to study injuries from the DTP vaccine. And they expected at that point that they were going to find one injury in every 15,000. When they actually started looking at it, they were finding one in every 300, and he panicked. And instead of calling NIH and alerting the world, he called an inside scientist who was a buddy of his at Merck. And said, or was it? No, it was Wyeth, I guess.
Wyeth at the time.
Yeah. Wyeth. And he said, you know, you better come up here and look what I got. And he came up there, and then they agreed, instead of completing the study, they would substitute another vaccine that had never been released and was just, you know, it was just kind of a fake vaccine to try to reduce the number of kids killed so that they could tell families, you know, better news. And that was the beginning.
Well, you know, this probably was, this is extraordinary on so many levels, the Deitch memo. And this memo is available on the website. You watch the film, you can go and get all of the documents that are not in the public domain. And the Deitch memo is one of those documents. It was a discovery document that was given to me by Mike Hugo, one of the original lawyers in vaccine injury litigation, who could not get these cases to court because they would settle before they got to a jury. And they had to do that because they could not have memos like the Deitch memo being paraded in a court of law. And you know this full well from your experience with Monsanto now. Discovery for these people when they've done something very bad is devastating. The Deitch memo is exactly as you say, Bobby. What happened is that they had not, since the introduction of the pertussis vaccine, 40 years later, they'd still not done a safety study. And there were reports from many physicians of problems with the cellular, the whole cell pertussis vaccine, injury, encephalopathy, death, permanent brain damage to children. And so they decided, it was actually the FDA funded a study at UCLA, and they were going to give 15,000 doses of this vaccine. Remember, every child could get up to 4 doses of the vaccine, 15,000 doses of the vaccine, and look at the rate of adverse reactions, anticipating, as you point out, a rate of seizures, a rate of serious neurological complications in 1 in 15,000 doses. Well, just 1,500 doses into the study, suddenly this character, Dr. Deitch, turns up at UCLA for a meeting with the principal investigator, Larry Barrow, a pediatrician from UCLA. And right there is a problem. Here we have a federally funded study, and suddenly you've got a representative of the pharmaceutical company whose the majority of vaccines being given in that study were from Wyeth. He turns up for this meeting. You should never do that. Dr. Barrow should never have met with him, and most certainly should never have disclosed interim pre-publication data. Data that he had not at that stage even revealed to the study sponsor, the FDA. And what he revealed to them, to Deitch, was that the rate of adverse reactions, serious neurological reactions to this vaccine, were actually, when you counted collapse shock along with seizures, it was 1 in 215 vaccines. Now, again, bear in mind, each child could receive up to 4 doses. So that is an extraordinarily high reaction rate when it was anticipated to be 1 in 15,000 for just seizures. And the physicians participating in the study saying this is unacceptable. This is an unacceptable rate of adverse reactions. This is too reactogenic. And so Barrow then went on. And at the end of this memo, it refers to Barrow having a meeting with the FDA. So after those 1,500 doses had been given, he had these appalling safety profile data for the DVT vaccine. He had a meeting with the FDA. Now, you and I know, Bobby, that if you went to the FDA with those interim data for a pharmaceutical drug, it would be pulled
into the
market. And this is, these are drugs that have been given to sick people, not healthy children. It would have been pulled immediately. That didn't happen. They went back, and suddenly, after that point, by the time they published the final paper when the 15,000 doses had been given, for some bizarre reason, some unaccountable reason, the rate of adverse reactions, just say seizures, had gone from 1 in 300 to 1 in 3,500 doses of the vaccine. What happened? And we've done an analysis. Brian Hooker did an analysis on this, and the odds of that happening by chance were 1 in 10,000. I mean, it was astonishing. That it was not chance. Something happened following that meeting between Baroff and Deitch, a meeting that should never have taken place. And when Wyeth realized that not only this was an extraordinary rate of adverse reactions, but their vaccine was the most commonly used vaccine in this trial, he went back to Wyeth and he reported his findings to his colleagues at Wyeth. And this is the basis of the Deitch memo that we obtained. And something very bad happened, in my opinion, at that point. My expectation, my theory, my belief is that the wholesale DPT vaccine was substituted with something else. Now, the other alarming thing about that memo, Bobby, is that there was disclosure in there that Wyeth already had an acellular pertussis vaccine, a safer vaccine, a vaccine they denied having, a vaccine they denied ever being able to produce, a vaccine that had they told Congress they could produce it, they would never have got liability protection in the 1986 Vaccine Injury Act. They kept it quiet. But they're disclosed in
there. They told Congress, Wyeth told Congress, look, we are losing $20 in downstream liability for every dollar we're making on this vaccine from sales. Number one. Number two, vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. You cannot make them safe. And that's why we need statutory protection. That's why we need you to insulate us from lawsuits. We need you to make it so nobody can sue us or we're going to stop making vaccines. If they had admitted to Congress that they could make a safer vaccine, Congress would have never given them the act. So they had to lie to Congress and say, we cannot make it safe. You've got to give us protection.
And what we now know, again, from those disclosure documents, that that's exactly what Lederle said. That Lederle internal memo says this is the safest vaccine we can make. There is no evidence that there is or ever was a safer vaccine. That's a complete lie. And now we find that Lederle, in those discovery documents, have a pattern from 1937, 60 years before that vaccine was ever licensed for an acellular vaccine of lower toxicity. How many children, Bobby, went to the wall in those 60 years to save pennies on the vaccine for these companies? And yet they lied to Congress, they lied to their senators, their policy, they lied to the doctors, they lied to the parents in order to get liability protection. And of course, what liability protection got them was the perfect business model. A mandatory market, children have to get the vaccines to go to school, and no liability. All they could do was make a profit. And that is exactly what they did.
And you ask how many kids have been sacrificed as collateral damage. And we know that those numbers are, 54% of kids now have chronic disease. And virtually all of those chronic diseases that began appearing after 1989 are diseases that are listed as injuries on the manufacturer's inserts of those vaccines. And those companies are making $500 billion a year selling the Adderall, the Concerta, the albuterol inhalers, the $600 EpiPens, the diabetes medication, the anti-seizure medication, the arthritis medications. We know are caused by vaccines. the same companies that are making $50 billion a year selling the mandatory vaccines to our children are making 10 times that selling the treatments that target the chronic diseases that they list as side effects on their own vaccine insert.
And people wonder why people like you and I are concerned about the rush to market for a vaccine against COVID-19 that Bill Gates anticipates giving to 7 billion people worldwide, circumventing the safety trials, taking away liability, but knowing that there is substantial risk. And that risk, as we know, is not going to be experienced necessarily in the first few days or even the first month. But if what we know about other vaccines, like the SARS vaccine and the dengue virus vaccine, it's going to come to haunt, back to haunt people maybe years later in a very, very severe way. What happens if we've given that to the entire population of the world at that
point? Yeah, and let me ask you something about that. You know, let me ask you about pathogenic priming. What do you, you know, that's a special danger from the coronavirus that we don't really see with other vaccines.
Yeah, we saw perhaps the most striking example in modern medicine, outside of the laboratory, outside the ferret studies with the SARS, the proposed SARS vaccine. We saw it with the dengue fever virus vaccine in the Far East. And there, the pharmaceutical company had made a vaccine which they knew. They knew before it went to market had problems, and they kept it quiet. And this is now the subject of criminal proceedings. But that was a viral vaccine that, when given to children, produced antibodies. It didn't appear to produce adverse reactions at an alarmingly high rate until those children then encountered the natural dengue fever virus. And when they did, they often had extreme reactions, and death was a frequent complication. And this is an example of where the immune system is set up by the initial exposure through the vaccine to overreact when it encounters the natural infection. Not to neutralize the natural infection, but to overreact and produce a sort of immune system meltdown in those who've received it. And of course, it doesn't happen within the time frame that the safety studies are conducted. But when it comes and when it happens, it is most severe. And those vaccines are now set up for life to have this severe reaction. Woe betide them should they encounter the natural infection, because who knows who's going to have a severe reaction. That is one of the major worries that you and I share about a COVID-19 vaccine just casually administered to 7 billion people.
Yeah, it's extraordinary to me. It just seems so reckless. Fauci has gone ahead with the Moderna vaccine, which his agency owns 50% of that patent. He's put in $500 million of U.S. taxpayer money into this vaccine. And I don't see how anybody, I mean, that, if that was any other medical product, it would be DOA. 20% of the people in the high-dose group were so badly injured by that vaccine that they had to be hospitalized. In the low-dose group, it was 6%. How can you give that vaccine to, you know, a billion people, which is what they're planning to do? And these were very, very healthy people. These were the best of the best of the best of the best. What happens when you give that to people, you know, like your typical American who's obese, who has diabetes, who has arthritis, who has asthma, who's vaping and smoking cigarettes and drinking and has all these other comorbidities? And then the fact that they skipped animal studies is just extraordinary, because we will never know. I mean, do they, as far as you know, is there any hint that we're not going to get pathogenic priming on these vaccines? Do they know something that we don't?
Well, one thing that was interesting, Bobby, is there was a delay in the next phase, I think it was of the Oxford trial, the Oxford coronavirus vaccine trial. They've been delayed. No one was told why they were delayed, but the suspicion is that they were delayed for safety reasons, and we need to know that. And the people receiving these experimental vaccines as part of trials need to know that as part of the process of informed consent. And I wonder whether they will be told. But the important thing about this film, and of course, we finished production on this film in November before we'd even heard of COVID-19. But the value of it is it looks into the past and the origins of the 1986 Act and what happened historically when these pandemics hit and they rushed a vaccine to market. And then they discovered that all of their assumptions were wrong and the vaccine was hurting people and the taxpayer had to pick up the bill for all of the damage done, not the drug companies, but the taxpayer. So it's a look into the past that enables us to now take a look at where we are right now and where we may be going if we get it wrong this time. The difference is, of course, it's on a global scale and it will be very likely, if it happens, mandatory.
I'm talking to Andrew Wakefield about his new film, 1986, and it's about the passage of the Vaccine Act. Andy, how are you going to get people to see this, given the censorship?
Well, it's now on two platforms. It's on our own platform, which is a secure site. It's 1986theact.com. People can go there. People are watching.
And can people see it? Can people see it right now today?
People in Italy are watching it. The Italians have been leading the charge in many ways in the popular protest, the uprising against mandatory vaccination. It's also playing on Sphere, which is a blockchain encrypted platform that is available for much more for the community experience around this. It's a new platform for people in the health freedom community that was set up precisely to cater for those people who found themselves being censored on traditional platforms. So sphir.io, go there for the community experience. So those are the two places. We're going to be announcing some further sites where it will be available to a different audience very soon. So far, Bobby, so good. I have no doubt that they will do their very best to try and stop us. It won't work.
And then are you going to have any theatrical release?
Absolutely. It will happen as soon as we can get back into theaters. And even though it's an odd way around, but the value of this kind of story, this kind of film, it happened with Vaxxed, is that people who'd seen it online still came to the screenings. And they came to the screenings because it created an extraordinary sense of community, an extraordinary sense of belonging and unity. And it unified this community in a way that I'd not seen for a very long time. We've been up against it and people start to fragment, communities start to fragment. There's this sort of siege mentality when people forget that the enemy is outside the gates and they start saying, why have we got no money, ammunition, food, and start arguing amongst each other. When Vax came along, there was this big coming together, which I think was terrifying to the authorities, to the companies, to people like Tony Fauci. And they love coming to the Q&As. And hopefully, Bobby, you'll be there and I'll be alongside you on several of these Q&As across the country. And people love to come for that experience. And they are able to tell their vaccine injury stories in a way they've never been able to express them before. And that was one of the great, very powerful things that emerged from your movie with Polly Tommy and Brian Burroughs, Vax 2, which brought out the parent stories in a really heartfelt, meaningful way. So I believe there will be a tremendous demand for theatrical exposure all over the world.
Hey, I continue to talk to Andy Wakefield about his new film, 1986, about the passage of VICA, of the Vaccine Injury Compensation Act in 1986. And I got one other last question for you, Andy. You are one of the most resilient human beings I've ever met. You've been beleaguered, besmirched, attacked, made a pariah. You have been absorbed more undeserved vitriol than anybody that I've met in my life. And yet you're so resilient and you always retain your optimism. So give us something give the rest of us something to be optimistic about.
Well, I'll tell you something, Bobby, two things. This film is inspiring. It's not a dark, melancholy movie. It's inspiring. And what inspires me and what should inspire people watching it is it's about one of the most powerful forces in the universe, and that is the force, the power of the maternal intuition, a mother's intuition. You talk about this in the film. And mothers know their children better than anyone. They don't do it deductively, logically. It's instinctive. It's a voice inside them that has been there and been cultivated, cultured, evolved over tens, hundreds of thousands of years. And it's the reason we're on this planet now. We're not here because of Tony Fauci or public health or vaccines or antibiotics or doctors. We're here because of maternal instinct. And we will be here in many thousand years' time if we choose to listen to that instinct. And that's really what this film is about. And the other thing that makes the job easy, Bobby, is having friends like you alongside me. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Andy. I see there's a lot of people we know who are on with us today, but one I want to make a note of and say hi to you too, from both of us, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, who's been one of the great leaders of this movement. Sherry, hi, how are you? Andy, thanks for joining me. Let me just probe you a little on that before I let you go, because one of the, you know, you tell this story about, I think it was your wife who had a sense, a premonition that her child was in danger from, I think, falling in a pool. I've had these experiences too. My wife who passed away, Mary, when we had a child who was very, very, who had 29 hospitalizations by the time he was 2 years old. He was severely asthmatic. And she could put her hand on him and know what the allergen was. And she would know whether he was wheezing and what his heart rate was. And I, you know, loved the child as much as she did, but I did not have that sensibility or the sensitivity or that capacity. And I just always marveled at that, that she knew what was wrong, what was threatening to that child in the environment. And when I started meeting all these women who said, you know, I know that the vaccine harmed my child, I knew they were telling the truth. I couldn't dismiss that. I had to give it credence. And I think that's the same thing that got you into this mess and ended up destroying your career, is this belief that the mother really knows what's happening to these children.
I have no doubt of it. And it's not an emotional argument. It's not an emotional nuance. It's a survival imperative. It is as old as the hills. It's an ancient wisdom. And the medical profession, and most certainly the industry, would like to usurp that. They'd like to take it away. They'd like to convince you that the doctor knows best. No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. And when people individually and collectively realize that power, and when husbands realize that they have it to some extent, but nothing like their wives, but they trust their wives' intuition, then they can take back that power.